my main response to the world is not one of anger. As I get older, I find it's one of disappointment. One of disappointment.
I was so disappointed by the events of the day.
Everybody will be so disappointed.
I'm very disappointed.
Hi, I'm Wendy, and you're listening to So Disappointed, the podcast that asks you about some of the things that have really let you down. Disappointment comes in so many forms. Maybe you've been disappointed by a film or television franchise, or an artist you admire, a political figure, an ideology, or just the human race in general. The permutations are endless. We'll be looking at why we get so invested in people and things to such an extent that we get angry when they let us down. Why do we care? What's wrong with us? What's wrong with them? In this episode, we're talking about aliens.
I don't think we could ask for a more beautiful evening, do you?
At 10:30 at night, on the 26th of July, 2023, I received a text out of the blue from an old friend I hadn't spoken to in ages. It said, "Room temperature superconductors and the US UFO hearings." I still don't understand the superconductor bit, and at the time, I had no idea what US UFO hearings were. But my friend sent me some links to videos of what I now know were the first UAP hearings. UAP. Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. I watched the 2023 hearing there and then. There's been a few more since then, and if you haven't seen them, we'll link to them in the show notes. But, in a nutshell, three seemingly very plausible military veterans testified under oath in front of the senators and congressmen and women about UFOs. One, David Grush, claimed that the US had recovered alien craft and bodies from crash sites. Another, Commander David Fravor, described his experience with what's now known as the Tic Tac craft, an unidentified aerial phenomena that can move at speeds and manoeuvre in a way that human-made craft can't, as far as we're aware. It's been caught on camera, and you can find numerous copies of that video on YouTube. It was midnight when I finished watching and reading everything I could find about that day's events, and I was wide awake. I wrote to my friend, "That's a lot to process, and I don't know how to deal with this. This changes everything." And then, "How can this be real? And do you believe it?" Over the next few days, I expected everyone's mind to be collectively blown wide open. We are not alone. We have made first contact. But the response was next to nothing. An almost cosmic partridge shrug of indifference. I was on the Hell site, formerly known as Twitter at the time, and I asked the people who followed me, "Why does nobody care about this?" Because nobody seemed to care about it. And I, who grew up with Mulder and Scully, I desperately wanted to believe. But at the same time, I just didn't. Not really. It's complicated. So what on earth was going on? How could a real life close encounters be so disappointing? Are we really that jaded? Or are there other factors at play? But hey, enough of my yakking. What do you say? Let's boogie. I'm sitting in a park in Edinburgh with resident psychologist David Myers so that we can talk about... We're not talking about the existence of aliens with David. It's not really your wheelhouse. But we're going to talk about belief or disbelief. So, David, at this point in human history, we seem to have more information than ever before from very credible witnesses that something that we don't understand is on Earth. And yet the response to that has just been a sort of a global shrug. And I'm assuming that's because we don't believe. So why might we not believe these very credible witnesses?
For me, I think it's because it's not necessarily whether we believe the witnesses or not, but who they're associated with. These are people who are associated in one way or another with the United States government, either because they've worked for the government, they've worked for the military, or organisations who are connected to the military in one way. So because they are connected to the US government, they're sort of damned by association with the US government. Public confidence in the US government among American public has been in decline ever since the time of the Vietnam War. The only times there's been an increase in public confidence in the US government has been during the times of Reagan, Clinton, and the first Trump presidency, very slightly.
I bet that dropped away fast.
It did when Biden came in, which is maybe what people wouldn't expect.
No. But then we're living in our
we're living in a bubble. In a very bubble polarized world.
Yes.
In terms of current trust in the US government, there's quite a lot of polling evidence around distrust in the US government, which I'll come on to in a second. In 2024, an organisation called the Edelman Trust Barometer, they did a special analysis on trust in government across the world. So they did they polled a representative sample of 1,000 people in each of 25 countries. And they asked them the question, do you trust your government to do what is right? Ranking the percentage of people who agreed, the US government ranked 18th out of 25, with 40% of the sample agreeing with that proposition.
Wow.
They were only ahead of France, Spain, Japan, Colombia, the UK, South Africa and Argentina.
I'm actually kind of proud that we distrust our government more.
Yeah.
So we're looking at these guys with their big medals and their big job titles, and we're thinking, we actually didn't believe you before and we're not going to believe you now.
Yeah, because they're connected to the government. If the government's everyday pronouncements aren't to be trusted, anybody connected to it, particularly if they're making extraordinary claims or claims which maybe even might have a degree of plausibility but would be out with the realms of possibility or probability, they have no credibility because they're backed by the government.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to ask you what I ask you every single time. What's going on in our heads when we're listening to these, as you say, extraordinary claims, extraordinary stories? Why are we struggling with this?
I think we're struggling with this because it comes down for me to the way we process information. I think whether we actually believe it or not is a separate issue. But in terms of the cognitive processes going on, there's an information processing model which was proposed by Petty and Cacioppo in 1986, and they called that the elaboration likelihood model. So when we take in information, it goes through one of two pathways, and those pathways help us to form or strengthen our opinions. There's the central route. The central route involves careful, really detailed analysis, critical thought. It's quite slow, it's labour-intensive, it takes effort. Whereas the peripheral route is much quicker, and it allows us to use what's known as heuristics, which are cognitive shortcuts, to make really quick judgments automatically and below our conscious control to process information.
And we just don't have enough information to actually make a decision about any of this stuff, do we?
We don't.
No, because our entire lives, it's like, no, that's just not, that doesn't exist. It's not true.
We're too busy for that. The information's too big. Also, most members of the public aren't really going to be all that highly motivated to analyse claims of contact with non-human intelligence. And as you just alluded to, they don't have the expertise to evaluate those claims.
Yeah.
So that means that straight away, any information of that nature that comes out into the public consciousness, they're going to hear it, they're going to process it through the peripheral route, it won't be in any depth.
What happens next?
So you've heard this information about the US government apparently being involved with alien technology or whatever. This is where what's known as schemas come in.
Okay.
Schemas are mental representations which contain information about objects, situations, people, etc. They help us to navigate the world and to predict what we can expect in future encounters with those things or things that are similar to those things and how we're likely to feel when we come across them. The greater exposure we've had to specific stimuli, the more detailed and more nuanced the schema will be, because we've built up like a bigger pot of information and it makes our processing much more automatic. When we're presented with information which is entirely novel or which doesn't fit with the established pattern of events, you get what's called schema violation, which means that it, you know, it just doesn't match what you already know.
Yeah.
That violation triggers cognitive dissonance, which we've discussed previously.
And we'll probably discuss again.
No doubt. Obviously, dissonance is really uncomfortable to deal with, and we try and resolve that as quickly as we can.
That's a really good point, because, you know, I talk about the fact that this all came to my attention because I got a text in the middle of the night from my friend going, aliens are real. And as a person who, you know, came up watching The X-Files, I'm fully, you know, fully Mulder and Scully. I want to believe, of course I do. But then when I'm presented with this information, I felt really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I don't want to believe.
No.
At least not this way. So, yeah, sorry, David, carry on.
That's what you've experienced there is cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
This might chime with your experience, it might not. The easiest way to resolve cognitive dissonance is to just dismiss the information that you've heard. And this is where the elaboration likelihood model comes in. So the model postulates that when the dismissal of the information occurs through heuristics, which are cognitive shortcuts, don't require a lot of processing or energy. They're very efficient. However, they're not always reliable. So whether the information that you've received or not is accurate doesn't matter. It just doesn't fit with what you already know. So likely heuristic-driven reactions to claims that Washington's involved with aliens or their technology would be, well, we know the government's incompetent and they're divided. There's absolutely no way they could keep something like this secret from us.
Yes.
Or if this were real, scientists would be talking about it.
Well, yes, this is why we talk to scientists.
So really, when claims that the US government has encountered non-human intelligence collide with our core assumptions, that challenges what we think about how the world works. Rejecting them is much more psychologically simple than rebuilding our entire understanding of the world around us.
Rebuilding our entire understanding of the world around us. That is exactly it. That is what I assumed would happen if we were able to believe this stuff, is it would completely rebuild our understanding of reality. And that's far too uncomfortable, and we're busy.
Yes, it's far too uncomfortable, and it's far too confronting. We live in a world where we're used to being dominant.
Yes.
Over everything else.
Yes. It's a little bit frightening. It's a little bit frightening. It's terrifying, the thought that, yeah. I can't even voice that. I'm sorry. I don't even want to like consider it. But having listened to the UAP hearings, that is actually that's the fundamental driver behind the fact that they're having these hearings, is that all of these very credible people are saying this is a risk to us, and unless we talk about it widely, then we're putting, well, what they said, the American public, but, you know, everybody at risk. But of course, they're just going to look at themselves. But that was the driver behind it, is we're afraid of these things that we don't know and we need you to deal with it. And the rest of the world just going, blah, 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 blah. Can't deal with this. Sorry. Too much.
is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the street to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen. And so on.
So where is everybody? That searching question was famously posed back in 1950 by Professor Enrico Fermi, an Italian-American physicist and so-called architect of the nuclear age, who was talking to some fellow scientists about the discrepancy between the frustrating lack of any conclusive evidence of advanced extraterrestrial life and the high likelihood of its existence. This became known as the Fermi paradox. During our research for this episode, our resident film critic Eddie Harrison, more of whom in a moment, put us in touch with his scientist friend, Professor James M. Scobby, who kindly agreed to explain the Fermi paradox in more detail. Professor Scobby's email is read here by actor Laura Hogg.
So the universe is huge, and there are literally billions of billions of stars like ours. So unless life is really unlikely, there should be millions or billions of places where life has evolved. And given that it's been 14 billion years, there must be and have been so many civilizations of sentient creatures. So how come none has shown up in a nice space traveling ship? Recently, we have also observed that there are lots of planets. We used to think that our solar system might be oddly unusual. The thinking goes the same for replicated life, but experiments and recent thinking suggest that any chemical soup will produce something interesting. Evolution is a general thing, it applies everywhere. So, Fermi's paradox suggests that something is an absolute showstopper. Could be that competition for resources or overrun on resources precludes advancement to effective space travel. Could be that faster than light is just not possible in any form. So there are many places life has advanced, but stuck on small islands of their own solar systems.
I think for most of us, our idea of what first contact with extraterrestrial life forms might be like has been guided quite significantly by the all-prevailing pop culture influence of science fiction cinema. We've all seen, for instance, Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a profoundly moving film in which a benign race of alien visitors want nothing more than to communicate peacefully with humankind. That's the perfect ideal, isn't it? It's what we all want. But the chances of it ever happening seem so unlikely. We'll probably never be invaded either, which is also disappointing in a way. We demand dramatic alien contact, dammit! So, has Hollywood raised our expectations to an unrealistic degree? Is that why we're all so disappointed? Our aforementioned film critic, Eddie Harrison, has thoughts.
So has Hollywood spoiled the idea of aliens for us? And I would say, yes, it has. So in terms of disappointment, I have a keen memory of going to see Star Wars in 1978. You know, I was like 9 years old with my family, and it was an absolute, you know, you left the cinema weak at the knees. And later that year, we went back to the cinema and we saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the Steven Spielberg film as follow-up to Jaws. And it was such a different experience, because instead of this kind of other world with kind of Wookiees and, you know, monsters and spaceships and whatever, your whole family are sitting watching this like drama about this kind of Richard Dreyfuss as this kind of very nerdy little guy who suddenly like chucks his job and chucks, you know, life away and becomes a kind of recluse and starts making models out of like, you know, paper mache and potato, and starts crafting little kind of models of the Devil's Tower because he had been contacted by aliens and they put this kind of vision into his mind. And then he goes and he sees the spaceship at the end, and then they even released a different version of the film where you actually see a little bit of inside the spaceship and you get to see the aliens. And it's almost like a kind of religious experience. You know, the tagline of the film is, you are not alone, we are not alone. And that is a kind of, that is an existentialist question, the kind of notion that as human beings, we are not alone in the universe, that there is something else there other than us, should be an absolute game changer. And that was the idea that you were sold sitting there in the cinema at 9 years old. It's like, one day there are going to be aliens and they're going to contact us. And the other thing that I didn't really understand, I was quite fascinated by Close Encounters when I was a kid, and I read Bob Balaban's diary, which was published at the time, which I bought for, I think, 15 pence in a secondhand bookshop. And he goes on about how he was hired for the film and he worked with François Truffaut. And I remember as a kid kind of thinking, why do you need a French guy in this story? Why is half of this film in subtitles? And then somebody pointed out to me in an observation that made me kind of blew my mind, that the whole point of Close Encounters is it's about language and it's about communication. And that's why you have people from different countries in it. And that's why they use subtitles. They don't have it's all about American people. It's about people from around the world. And they have to agree on a language, which turns out to be music. So all of this is big, highfalutin stuff, and it raised your expectations as a kid. Look, they wouldn't be prepping us for meeting aliens one day unless something's likely to happen. This is going to happen to us one day. We're going to be contacted by aliens, and we'll probably use music to contact, you know, we'll use music to communicate, or flashing lights. And it's going to be this big messianic moment where we're going to have this experience. And lo and behold, nothing like that ever really happens.
If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the pipe tones.
So would you say, Eddie, that in the 40-plus years since Close Encounters came out, we've lost our sense of belief, or need, even, that something like the events depicted in the film might one day actually happen?
What you get is, every so often there's a documentary on Netflix where they say, yes, we're going to look into real-life alien encounters. These people saw lights in the sky, and then we found out next week that there was a Mexican fireworks festival going on. And you think, oh, right, OK, well, it's probably the Mexican fireworks festival that they saw and not aliens. So in a way, it all becomes part of, I would say, the kind of the idea that conspiracy theories when we were young were really exciting. We're like, oh, this incredible idea that the establishment don't want you to know. But what the establishment ended up doing to cover over everything is just releasing their own conspiracy theories and flooding the market with kind of white noise, with nonsense. So there are now so many conspiracy theories around that we're not really interested, that we're not really excited. So maybe the American government does have a secret Area 51 where there's a whole bunch of spaceships, where there's alien creatures' bodies. Maybe they do. But what difference is it going to make to me? All that sense of wonder, what they call Spielbergian awe, all of that has completely dissipated. It's gone. Spielberg's just a filmmaker now. He's not like somebody who's telling us about this exciting world that we believe might be just around the corner. In fact, it's completely the opposite now. If aliens came down, we'd be like, oh, what do you think of Brexit? You know, how do you feel about, you know, the Trump administration or whatever? You know, we're kind of now so self-orientated, and we've lost that sense of awe and wonder.
One of the interesting things that they suggest in the documentary, which is called The Age of Disclosure, mm-hmm. is that now we know this to be true, that the CIA did help fund certain films that pushed certain stories, certain ideas. We know that. Mm-hmm. That happened. But one of the things that they suggested, and I'd really like to know your opinion on this, because again, as I'm watching this documentary, immediately and I'm going to bleep this, you know, my bullshit sensors are going off. Mm-hmm. You can push me so far with certain things around aliens. It's really interesting when we talked to David. He said, well, lights in the sky, that's plausible. We've experienced lights in the sky. But then they start talking about interactions with aliens, and then they start talking about being on the craft, and you're like, yeah, this isn't true anymore. But one of the things that they said had absolutely happened was that a campaign to raise or to increase the stigma around believing in aliens and alien encounters was mounted by the CIA in order to hide what was actually going on. Mm-hmm. Do you believe it's possible that film has... So, but have they deliberately stigmatized aliens, and have they deliberately stigmatized people who believe in aliens and believe they've been abducted?
I think you'd really need to ask an alien whether they feel stigmatized or not by what's been going on. I think it's right to say that it has been stigmatized. If you think about it, I said that character, I think it's Ron Neary in Close Encounters, that he is almost like a kind of a disciple character. He's like somebody who has a vision of things, and that vision turns out to be correct, and we as the audience go along on that journey with him, and he's resourceful, and he finds his way to this place, and he's rewarded by this trip in the alien spaceship, and he's taken away and we don't know where, and that's all very magical. But then, you know, I was talking about that kind of flooding of the zone with kind of bad information, is that, you know, the more films that we saw about aliens, the less we got into the idea that they were benevolent, friendly, you know, with wonderful technology, and how could they help us? You know, movies like Contact have that kind of idea in them. But then we eventually come back to where we were in like the 50s with kind of paranoid, you know, what would the aliens do to us? And you get to the kind of Independence Day kind of movies, you get to these kind of like, they would all just want to kind of blow us to bits. And I guess maybe this reflects the idea that we are more fearful now. You know, alien kind of movies, threatening alien movies work in times of kind of great social anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, that the invasion of the Body Snatchers reflects our fears about communism or something like that. But each time you remake that movie, it's about something slightly different because it reflects whatever we're worried about in society at the time. And now, I guess, I think that we're kind of so overwhelmed by our own fears, or our fears are kind of fed by the media, so that we're no longer looking for this kind of positive experience, because I think we've given up on the idea that aliens are ever going to come and rescue us and things are going to get good. And I do think that, you know, you could argue that it's in the interest of the government for us not to kind of believe in these things, and for us just to kind of get on with things and to stigmatize. You know, if you think about kind of Saturday Night Live sketches where you have survivors of alien encounters kind of saying, yeah, you know, I was driving my car along the road and, you know, one day I saw bright lights and, you know, I was taken away and they interfered with me and they put me back. You know, it's seen as a kind of crank thing, as something, you know, a tall story that you've made up, something that a weirdo might say. And it's no longer the kind of suggestion that maybe you'll have this adventure, but just, oh, did you think you had the adventure? Actually, do you know what? You're just mad. You're just crazy. This part of me still wants to believe it, but I don't really believe it the way that I was quite excited about it when I was like 9 years old. You know, I was kind of like, wow, this is going to happen. Because that's the persuasive thing about the movies, is that they can make you believe things. Or certainly when you're impressionable enough, you can kind of get on board with that. And I kind of feel that I'm lucky to belong to that generation that had that, as I said, Spielbergian awe of E.T. and Close Encounters. And that kind of positive outlook that we kind of thought, yeah, maybe something amazing is going to happen. And maybe everybody's not just going to laugh at me as some kind of freak because I believe this.
Back now to psychologist David Myers.
One of the things that Paul and I kind of butted up against as we were doing our research for this episode was the fact that we wanted to believe what we were listening. Certainly, we believed that the people speaking believed in what they were saying. But whenever those claims kind of dipped into, and then we went on the spaceship, or and then we were taken off the planet, or and then I came face to face, or you know it's, there's a line after which you just completely stopped believing in that person and all credibility was lost. Why do we disbelieve people who have these experiences or who claim to have these experiences?
The scale of the claim really matters here, which you've just alluded to.
Yes.
It's central to how the listener's going to perceive the experiencer. If they're reporting having seen lights in the sky, that's a really easy thing to understand or even accept, because there's many possible explanations for that. This won't really rub up against representativeness or availability heuristics. because it's likely to have happened. We've all seen something. Seeing an unusual object in the sky is still plausible. Again, the heuristics won't be likely to dismiss the information. Seeing a craft overhead or interacting with something or landing begins to step into the realms of the implausible. So heuristics will begin to be violated.
Yep.
Once you've reached seeing or somehow interacting with an alien or being on board a craft, it's so unlikely that the account has violated the schemas and the heuristics entirely, because the information just doesn't fit and the claims are going to be dismissed. So whether you believe them or not, your brain doesn't. That's not the end of the story, though. You also start looking at them, because the schema representing them has been violated, and you'll start to view them negatively. So you make judgments about them that are in line with what's known as the fundamental attribution error. This error works in two ways. When we find fault with ourselves, we tend to blame external factors. We've all done it. I'm late for work, so it's the fault of being in traffic. The roads are on chaos. It's not I woke up an hour late and I went to bed 2 hours late last night.
It's not my fault.
Not my fault. However, when you're looking to find fault with other people, you look for factors which we can attribute to coming from within them. So in this situation, well, he's clearly confused about something. He's not very well. He's putting himself under a lot of pressure at work, etc. So it doesn't matter who this person is or how credible they were to begin with. As soon as somebody comes out with something which really doesn't fit with them, their credibility has been diminished and they are dismissed. There's also something bigger going on here. So contact with aliens would likely trigger a significant existential crisis. It would turn our understanding of the universe, our planet, of ourselves on its head. The mechanisms which give our life meaning, so our religion, our national identity, morality, science even, they start to lose their power because we're no longer the top of the food chain, as you mentioned early on. It's far too great an idea to wrap our heads around, and it's too discomforting to give credence to. So again, it's dismissal. We dismiss it because the alternative is too destabilising to contend with. So we've all said things like this. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. That's the heuristic that we would involve there.
And this is where the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and we're being buzzed by a golden retriever. It's wonderful. It's running around us. It's amazing. But this is where what I actually think is part of the how we experience the claims that we're hearing and why we believe them, or why we just don't care.
Yeah.
Why we're just like, oh nah, this doesn't matter. And it's because there are no gigantic craft sitting in the air creating enormous thunderstorms. You know, it's not the start of War of the Worlds by Steven Spielberg. It's not Close Encounters. It's not Independence Day. It's not gigantic visuals. It's small stories and little experiences that other people have had. And so we can't take it in because we're not experiencing it.
No, absolutely not. If we were to experience it ourselves, it might change. But how do we know what we've really seen?
Yeah.
You can't, because we've got no frame of reference.
This is true.
It's better for us, really, that aliens are science fiction. You can turn off the TV and close the book.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Wendy.
Whether you're heavily into UFOs and extraterrestrials, or whether you're just dipping in and out, you will have come across Area 51. This is the area in the desert in America where supposedly the Roswell craft and the bodies from the Roswell craft are held. And it's also where supposedly they are continuing to reverse engineer the alien craft that have been captured. And I don't know. I think supposedly aliens live there. I don't know. It's hard to say. But the epicenter of North American UFO lore is Area 51. And Generation Z had an interesting approach to finding out what was going on in Area 51. So we're going to hand over now to our Generation Z correspondent, Sprite Kirkwood, to tell us about a very famous, I believe you guys call it a post.
Yes, the actual Wikipedia page does call it a satirical post.
We're going to bleep that.
Okay, sardonic post, my bad.
Nice.
Yes, so there was a post created by Matty Roberts in June 2019 called Raid Area 51, They Cannot Stop Us All, which originally was made as a silly joke poking fun at UFO culture and alienology. Don't know if that's a word, but it is now.
It is now.
It is now.
Yep.
It was a...
Ufology.
Ufology, that's the word that I was looking for.
Yep.
But it was basically a post saying if a bunch of people were to run at Area 51 all at once, there's no way they could stop us all and we could find the aliens and get them out of there.
So they were. So the idea was just get a huge gang of people, mm-hmm. everyone just runs Area 51 mm-hmm. and hopes that they're not taken out.
Well, the specific tactic that a lot of users were going to use was Naruto running.
Naruto.
Naruto, which is a 90s anime slash manga series in which the main characters are famous for running with their arms stretched out behind them like Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay. So they're going to Naruto run at Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what happened with this Facebook post?
Yes. So the Facebook post originally was just a throwaway, silly joke post. But in like the next coming days after the Raid Area 51 post was made, I think about 2 million people all said that they were interested in raiding Area 51 on the now infamous date of September 20th, 2019.
Wow. Okay. So 2 million people have said, yeah, let's do it. Let's Naruto run at Area 51. They can't stop us all.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
And in the lead up to it, there was a massive amount of... Well, it was a meme. So there was a large amount of memes that were made around it. People speculating as to how it will go, what might be in Area 51, what's going on in there. And I remember specifically there was a genre of meme of like, me escaping Area 51 with blank, and it's some absurd unknown thing. So like, I've escaped Area 51 and I finally found Windows 9.
Okay.
Which, that was one of my favourite posts that I saw from back then. 2 million people said that they were interested. Only about 150 people actually showed up to Area 51 on September 20th.
So disappointing.
So disappointing. There was a music festival, in fact, in a couple of towns nearby to Area 51 in the lead-up called Alienstock.
Wow.
Where they had a bunch of, like, alien-themed raves. I think one of the main reasons that not many people showed up is that it was a random desert in Nevada. Another reason is that the US government did actually say to people, hey, do not do this. You will be either arrested or shot if you attempt to break in here.
And here's what a government spokesperson actually said on record with the Washington Post about this wild plan. Area 51 is an open training range for the US Air Force, and we would discourage anyone from trying to come into the area where we train American armed forces. The US Air Force always stands ready to protect America and its assets. So there you go. Sinister. That's me talking now, not the spokesperson. That would be a weird way to end an official government statement. Anyway, let's wrap things up. So here we are at the end of the episode. And what have we learned? Well, I don't know what you've learned, but I know what I've learned. I know that expectation leads to disappointment. I know that I'm kind of built not to believe. As David Myers said, even if I wanted to believe, my brain won't let me. And no matter how many very plausible documentaries I watch, no matter how many UAP hearings there are, no matter how much evidence is placed before me, until the sky turns purple, the clouds fill with gigantic alien spaceships hanging in the air in just exactly the same way bricks don't, I'm going to have a really, really hard time believing that aliens are here. But I can tell you one thing. I really want to believe. Listening to So Disappointed. If you like the show, please drop us a like and a review, and please tell your friends. We'd like to thank our contributors for this episode: Professor James Scobby, actor Laura Hogg, our Gen Z correspondent Sprite Kirkwood, our resident psychologist Dave Myers, and our resident film critic Eddie Harrison. So Disappointed is written, presented and edited by me, Wendy Jordan, and Paul Whitelaw.
I'll do a bit of zoom. One more thing, and then my heart went boom. Something, something, and you're in the room.